Welcome to The Character Cure. I'm Dr. Paul Miller. Justice, Part 1. In his letter from a Birmingham jail, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." This potent thought is based on the belief that our lives are all interconnected. A man or woman of noble character is careful not to harm or injure another person, whether or not he or she is closely connected with them. In other words, we're all in this life together. When we personally perform an act of injustice, our character is diminished, and the moral fabric of our society wears thinner. But those who possess the virtue of justice go beyond simply avoiding harm to others. They actively promote justice in seeking to relieve suffering and redress wrongs. In this podcast, we'll examine justice in a couple of different ways. First, justice is a personal virtue that guides your actions and directly impacts those who are most closely connected with you. Second, we'll look at justice as a state of the society in which we live. We call this social, political, and legal justice. While we'll focus most of our time on the first meaning of cultivating a personal sense of justice, we can't talk about one without also talking a bit about the other. Before taking up Aristotle's views on justice, let's highlight a couple of examples, one from literature and one from history. One of the most popular fictional treatments of justice and mercy is Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. You're probably familiar with the protagonist, Jean Valjean, who's released from prison after serving a sentence of 19 years for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his sister's starving children. Valjean then steals a set of costly silverware from a saintly bishop, who had allowed him to stay the night. He's quickly arrested and brought back to the bishop to face charges. In a profound act of mercy, the bishop claims that he had given the silver to Valjean as a gift. He then offers Valjean 2 silver candlesticks to match the silverware, urging him to sell the silver and use the money to become an honest man. The bishop then quietly proclaims, "Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil, but to good. It is your soul that I buy from you. I withdraw it from black thoughts and the spirit of perdition, and I give it to God." Shocked by the bishop's unwarranted kindness, Valjean takes the silver and leaves. After one more petty theft, he repents and begins a new life, transformed by the power of mercy. As we explore the meaning of justice as one of the cardinal virtues, we'll try not to lose sight of the essential role of kindness and mercy and tempering the impersonal demands of blind justice. In fact, true justice as a personal virtue is probably more about kindness and mercy than it is about ensuring that criminal behavior is punished. In Les Misérables, police inspector Javert, who relentlessly pursues Valjean for parole violation, represents the harshness and inhumanity of the letter of the law. Ironically, his ardent pursuit of justice becomes unjust. The bishop, who possesses an abundance of love in his treatment of others, is the just man. One reason he shows mercy is that he recognizes how Valjean's character has been deformed by injustice. His original sentence of 5 years in prison was clearly excessive and unjust. As further punishment for attempting to escape from prison, he ends up serving 19 years as the victim of a thoroughly unjust penal system. Now let's consider a brief historical example that further highlights the pernicious effects of injustice. In his biography, the former slave and abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass describes both how a man was made a slave and how a slave was made a man. He maintains an unshakable belief in the capacity of the human spirit to rise above suffering and injustice. But such a capacity is ravaged by the hopelessly brutal conditions of slavery. One of the most powerful passages in Douglass's narrative describes his despair in the midst of slavery. Quote, "I was broken in body, soul, and spirit. My natural elasticity was crushed. My intellect languished. The disposition to read departed. The cheerful spark that lingered about my eye died. The dark night of slavery closed in upon me, and behold, a man transformed into a brute." Close quote. One of Douglass's salient observations is regarding the brutalizing effects of slavery upon both slave and slaveholder. His slave master's wife, who initially showed him unusual kindness in giving him reading lessons, is eventually influenced by her husband's callousness to begin behaving as a typical slaveholder. In A Perceptive Insight, Douglass observes that slavery proved as injurious to her as it did to me. But he's also careful to point out that the damage to her character and personality were not necessarily permanent. The woman was moved to tears many years later when she witnessed the horrifying results of his mistreatment by another master. Her former kindness returned to some extent as she nursed Douglass back to health. While injustice transforms one's character for evil, love can transform it for good. Douglass, of course, became one of the greatest orators and most influential writers of the 19th century, using his immense talents and working tirelessly for the abolition of slavery and for equal rights. From Les Miserables, we see an imitation of justice as a cold and heartless quest to uphold the law, as well as a higher form of justice, tempered by mercy and unearned grace, that can break through the wretchedness of life. From the biography of Frederick Douglass, we see injustice as a pervasive and institutionalized state of society. As such, slavery ravages the character of both slaves and slaveholders. We also learn about the power and resilience of the human spirit to rise above the harrowing effects of injustice. In our quest to more precisely define justice as a personal virtue, let's now turn to Aristotle. Here again, we'll start with his philosophical framework in Nicomachean Ethics. It's significant to note that Aristotle uses the word dikaiosyne to describe justice. This word conveys a more general meaning of righteousness, complete virtue, or total honesty in your dealings with other people. Justice as dikaiosyne is the highest of all virtues, and it might also be the most difficult of all virtues to cultivate. For Aristotle, justice is not a one-sided application of the law that stands in opposition to mercy and kindness. It's more of a balance between strict justice and mercy, as we normally speak of the two. In this expanded and higher sense, we could say the bishop acted toward Jean Valjean based on a refined sense of justice. In the simplest terms, the virtue of justice makes you inclined to do things that are fair and just in relation to other people. It's how you regulate your conduct toward others. In many ways, the principles of justice are straightforward and easy to understand. However, the fact that the world is filled with injustice indicates that these principles are easy to disregard and difficult for many people to apply. From Aristotle's perspective, living in Athens 2,400 years ago, the laws of a democratic society do a pretty good job of prescribing just behavior and governing the social conduct of citizens. You would be punished, for example, if you committed violence toward other people, or if you unfairly defamed or slandered them. When the legal justice system works, guilty people are punished with a just verdict and innocent people avoid punishment. Aristotle acknowledges that there are many cases where laws can't spell out precisely what's just and what's unjust. Sometimes it depends on the circumstances. In these cases, we need wise and equitable people who are willing to go beyond what's required by the law in treating their families, associates, and even strangers with honesty, respect, and fairness. Justice, as a fully developed virtue, possesses the judgment and the courage to do the right thing with or without the strict regulatory guidance of the law. While Aristotle would like to maintain his focus on justice as a wide-ranging and comprehensive virtue, he chooses to discuss what he calls partial justice, rather than justice as a whole comprehensive virtue. One aspect of justice controls the distribution of good fortunes, such as wealth and honor. Justice also properly distributes the burdens of society, such as caring for the poor and needy, and risking your life in defending the freedom of your fellow citizens. Unjust people take more than their share of material things and good fortune, and very often they accept less than their share of societal burdens. According to Aristotle, the primary motive for injustice is the pleasure that comes from profit. In terms of promoting a just standard for wealth distribution, Aristotle advocates a meritocracy. In other words, people should be given what they deserve. If two people are more or less equal before the law and equal in terms of their individual merits, they should receive equal shares. But if they aren't equal, their shares of wealth and honor and other good fortunes should not be equal. Aristotle disagrees with an oligarchic form of distribution where power and privilege is based on existing wealth. But he also disagrees with a democratic form of distribution where everyone receives an equal share regardless of merit. A related part of justice deals with your transactions with other people. Aristotle divides transactions into two categories, voluntary and involuntary. Voluntary transactions include borrowing money, hiring someone to do a job, and selling a product or service. Involuntary transactions include theft, assault, violence, and defamation. These are termed involuntary because the person who suffers from the crime does not in any way accept it voluntarily. Your voluntary transactions need to be characterized by fairness and reciprocity. This means that you pay a fair price for products and services and you return what you borrow. Here we're talking about common sense principles of justice that are often disregarded in the world of business. When you're wronged during a transaction, Aristotle says you need a rectifying form of justice. Such justice should not favor the wealthy or the powerful. It can't be based on your social status or overall merits. All that matters here is the damage caused by the unjust transaction. A rectifying form of justice restores balance, equality, or equilibrium to the relationship. In some cases, it's a matter of reciprocity, or suffering appropriately for your unjust action. It means letting the punishment fit the crime. Of course, this is easier said than done. The damage caused by some crimes, like theft, are easier to quantify than others. It's difficult to put a price on something like defamation, and reciprocity is difficult to apply in cases that involve violence. Aristotle suggests that to maintain order in society, sometimes a just punishment needs to go beyond reciprocity. For example, the punishment for striking a police officer is not to be struck back by the officer. It needs to be punished by something like prison time, a fine, or both. In his attempts to define the formal structures of justice, Aristotle affirms that just rulers seek justice for everyone. They don't favor their families, friends, and associates more than the less fortunate. Just rulers don't become tyrants who take more than their share of wealth. They're satisfied with the rewards of honor and privilege. Here again, Aristotle knows that establishing and maintaining justice in the real world is difficult. It requires practical wisdom, consistency, and a willingness to acknowledge that we all commit acts of injustice at one time or another. In fact, even people who have strenuously cultivated the virtue of justice as a central part of their character will commit unjust acts incidentally or unintentionally. If this is true, it ought to inspire us with a more forgiving and generous attitude, especially when we suffer small injustices or experience petty grievances. In many cases, the blame for an unjust transaction has to be shared. For example, part of the responsibility for an act committed out of anger rests with the person who provoked the offender to anger. In terms of unjust distribution of wealth, part of the blame rests on the person who acquires more than his or her share of goods, but the person who distributes the good is also likely to be in error. One of Aristotle's most significant points is that acting unjustly yourself is generally a greater evil than being treated unjustly, even when you suffer an extreme form of injustice. This makes sense when we're thinking about justice as a personal virtue. Greater harm is caused to your character when you commit an injustice than when you suffer an injustice. Of course, such a thought would rarely offer consolation to someone who's been wronged. Some forms of justice result in levels of injury that can't be quantified, causing the sort of harm that destroys lives and livelihoods. But knowing that intentional acts of injustice committed by you will diminish your character can at times stop the cycle of violence and prevent you from perpetuating the injustice. A final question that Aristotle seems to care a lot about is whether it's possible to be unjust toward yourself. He concludes that it's only possible unintentionally or involuntarily. This is because you can't both perform the act and suffer from it at the same time. On a related note, people who commit suicide act unjustly toward the state and to their families, not toward themselves. So there you have it, a quick overview of Aristotle's views on justice as a personal virtue and some insights into the formal structure of justice in society. Unfortunately, Aristotle has probably left us with more questions than answers. But before we get to the questions and the criticism, let's summarize his most salient points. First, in the sense that justice is total honesty and fairness in your dealings with other people, it's the highest of all virtues. Justice balances the demands of the law with the moral obligation to show kindness and offer forgiveness. Second, justice as a fully developed virtue has the judgment and the courage to do the right thing with or without the strict regulatory guidance of the law. In other words, the legal justice system typically cannot achieve true justice without the wisdom and judgment of virtuous people. Third, Aristotle believes that the good fortunes of life, such as wealth and honor, ought to be distributed based on merit rather than strict equality. Fourth, when you're wronged by another person, a rectifying form of justice is needed to restore equilibrium to the relationship. This restoration of balance should be based on reciprocity and should not favor the wealthy or the powerful. Fifth, just rulers are properly rewarded with honor rather than wealth. Sixth, it's possible to commit acts of injustice toward yourself, but only indirectly or unintentionally. Seventh, justice is difficult. While the principles of justice are in some ways straightforward and easy to understand, justice is not easy to achieve in the real world. Because it is so difficult, we should not be surprised when just people commit acts of injustice unintentionally. Finally, and perhaps most important, Aristotle affirms that committing an act of injustice is a greater evil than suffering as the target of someone else's injustice. Now let's turn to a brief critique of Aristotle. Even before immersing ourselves in the findings of social science, we know enough to acknowledge some places where Aristotle, as a product of his time, clearly misses the mark. First of all, a meritocracy might sound fair and just in theory, but when we consider Aristotle's views on political equality, we immediately see some critical defects. In a political sense, Aristotle believes justice applies only among citizens who are equal before the laws of ancient Greece. This means free, male property owners. Aristotle and his contemporaries don't seriously consider the possibility that slaves or even women could merit full equality before the law or equality in the distribution of justice. In his ethical reflection, Aristotle for the most part accepts the social arrangements of his world as they are. He doesn't concern himself as much as he should with injustice in the way Greek social and political institutions may have been organized. Consequently, the idea that all men are created equal is not part of Aristotle's worldview. On the contrary, he believes that some men are incapable of making proper use of their freedom, that some men are natural leaders and even masters, and that others need to be told and instructed what to do. Now, we don't have any trouble affirming that people have their own distinct gifts and unequal capacities for leadership. And to his credit, Aristotle points out that some men who live in bondage to other men are more than capable of being in a position of authority. Furthermore, men who are in authority often prove themselves unworthy of such freedom and undeserving of the right to rule. But it's obvious that Aristotle's apologetic description of what he terms natural slavery can have no place in our quest for justice today. The same is true, for the most part, of Aristotle's views toward women. Even the most sympathetic reading of his portrayal of women clashes with our continuing struggle to promote the equality of the sexes. Aristotle does suggest that women have the innate ability to cultivate leadership qualities such as practical wisdom. In fact, he suggests their prudential judgment can even be superior to men's. But his strong tendency to accept the status quo in political and family relationships leads him to conclude, as a matter of fact, that women simply lack the authority to rule. He also surmises that women are less capable of fully developing other essential virtues such as courage. So, before we bring Aristotle's definition of justice into the 21st century, we'll need to make it more inclusive. The principles of justice have to apply equally to everyone. Even a cursory reading of world history makes clear that injustices have been heaped upon women and minority groups since the beginning of time. Any conversation about justice today can't turn a blind eye to those who are oppressed or living in bondage, either physically, economically, or emotionally. The lingering legacies of slavery and other forms of oppression make it impossible to embrace a pure standard of meritocracy in distributing wealth and other privileges in today's society. When it comes to modern reflection on the virtue of justice, we have a lot of ground to cover. Next time, we'll do our best to bring our conversation about justice into the 21st century. We won't have time to thoroughly address the hot-button issues of today, such as racial bias and police brutality, the immigration crisis in Europe, and rising income inequality. However, we should be in a better position to understand these emotionally charged live debates at the end of the next podcast segment. Welcome back to The Character Cure. Justice, Part 2. In our last podcast segment, we made some progress in defining justice. Aristotle gave us some helpful insights, but we also paid attention to some areas in which Aristotle's views came up short. We're ready now to explore some historical and social scientific evidence regarding the work of justice. Let's begin by discussing a man who dedicated his life to promoting justice as social and political equality. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. believed his personal calling was to be a co-participant with God in the work of justice. King's heritage within the Black Church included a firm belief in a personal God who suffers and struggles with humanity to overcome evil through the power of love. One thing we learn from the life of Dr. King is that sometimes the motivation to fight for justice requires something akin to a religious call. King's biographer Marshall Frady describes an experience that has become known as the Kitchen Table Epiphany. It occurred in January of 1956 in the midst of the Montgomery bus boycott. After a traumatic traffic arrest, which caused him to fear for his life, King was released from prison to return home. He received several threatening phone calls and soon became overwhelmed with his responsibilities, his unworthiness, and what he described as the superficiality of his inherited call into the ministry. What followed was a spiritual experience that would provide him with the conviction to stand firm in the face of severe trials for many years to come. Quote, "Dropping his head into his hands, he suddenly realized he was praying aloud in the midnight hush of the kitchen. Lord, I am down here trying to do what's right. But Lord, I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. And I can't let the people see me like this. But I've come to the point where I can't face it alone." And at that moment, as King would tell it, he seemed to hear an inner voice, the voice of Jesus, answering him, "Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you, even until the end of the world." That voice of Jesus, King recounted, promised never to leave me. No, never to leave me alone. Close quote. As a result of this experience, King acquired a more profound sense of his personal mission in life. It was vitally important for him to know that God was actively involved in working with him and others to change the world. In his final sermon, King claimed to see, quote, "God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world." Close quote. With steady determination, Dr. King embraced his personal life's work to promote justice and lead his fellow citizens to what he termed the Promised Land. In 1968, at age 39, his life was cut short by an assassin's bullet. Whether or not we share King's religious faith, we can appreciate his commitment to justice through the power of love and nonviolence. One of King's most repeated phrases is, "The universe is on the side of justice." However, he also warned about the danger of passively accepting the illusion that a, quote, "new age will roll in on the wheels of inevitability," close quote. According to King, we must speed up the coming of the inevitable. In his letter from a Birmingham jail, he defends his proactive stance against the criticism of white church leaders who feel that he is overly anxious and even reckless in his desire to bring about social change. The following quotation eloquently captures his frustration with the liberal clergymen who preferred a more gradual approach in the struggle for justice and equality. Quote, "For years now I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with a piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. It has been a tranquilizing thalidomide, relieving the emotional stress for a moment, only to give birth to an ill-formed infant of frustration. We must come to see with the distinguished jurist of yesterday that justice too long delayed is justice denied. We have waited more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. I guess it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging dart of segregation to say, wait." Close quote. According to King, human progress always, quote, "comes through the tireless efforts and persistent work of men willing to be co-workers with God," close quote. The Christian ministers who opposed King's urgent calls for extreme action had a more passive view of God's involvement in history and the responsibility of human beings to force social change. In a 1958 article, King writes, quote, "Laws do not change attitudes, but at least they control behavior. We need laws to change the habits of men while we wait on religion and education to change their hearts," close quote. King was clearly not an idealist who believed that education and rational argument could by themselves change deeply rooted racial prejudice. Permanent transformation of society would require the coercive force of law and nonviolent resistance, in addition to, quote, "the power of the agape ethic," close quote. King's drive for equality and justice was based on this principle of nonviolent resistance. From his perspective, nonviolent resistance provided the foundation for an authentically Christian campaign against injustice. He appealed to the example of Jesus as an extremist for love, truth, and goodness in his argument that the nation and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. King believed in the power of human creativity when empowered by God's call for justice. In his view, quote, "Christ furnished the spirit and motivation while Gandhi furnished the method," close quote. The purpose of nonviolent resistance is to generate social change using a middle path between acquiescence and violence. King emphasized that it is first and foremost not a method for cowards. Nonviolent resistance calls for courageous and self-sacrificing resistance, but it also requires a high level of self-discipline that includes a willingness to accept suffering without retaliation. King taught that unearned suffering can be redemptive, and yet the nonviolent resistor also needs to accept the possibility that the forces of evil can destroy his or her life before redemption occurs. Another key to the power of nonviolent resistance is that it, quote, "does not seek to humiliate or defeat the opponent, but to win his friendship and understanding," close quote. The ultimate goal is redemption and reconciliation, rather than victory in battle. King characterized the selfless love required by nonviolence as a stern love, which leads to collective action in the fight for justice. When possessed with this type of love, the nonviolent resistor can direct his or her attack on the forces of evil rather than on individuals doing the evil. In his relatively short life, Dr. King showed us what it means to possess the virtue of justice. There's so much more we could discuss about his life and legacy. But with that brief introduction, let's continue exploring what we can learn from both history and social science about justice as a personal virtue. One of the reasons justice is so difficult to achieve within human society is that we all have blind spots in the way we view injustice. No matter what our political, social, and religious views might be, we fail to perceive some forms of injustice. This is one of the many reasons we should promote continuous and open dialogue with our fellow citizens. Sometimes this is the only way to transform unjust attitudes and address moral blind spots. As an example of what I'm talking about, let's look at the ethics of torture. Now, the use of enhanced interrogation in gathering information from suspected terrorists is a complex issue. The line between harsh interrogation and torture can be difficult to define. However, it's clear that the line has been crossed in recent years by the United States government. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, torture was rationalized as an appropriate means of preventing another imminent terrorist attack. Justified by some as a necessary evil during a national emergency, such methods continue to be condoned by the majority of American citizens. It's instructive here to analyze the influence of religious faith on American attitudes toward societal justice. The work of abolitionists before the Civil War and the civil rights arguments advanced by Martin Luther King were both grounded heavily in religious convictions. But religious arguments don't always have a net positive impact on the struggle for justice. A much-discussed 2009 national survey by the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life presented a disturbing picture of the correlation between religious faith and attitudes toward torture. The survey revealed that 62% of white evangelical Protestants believed that the torture of suspected terrorists was either often or sometimes justified. 51% of white non-Hispanic Catholics and 46% of mainline Protestants shared a similar opinion on the acceptability of torture. By contrast, only 40% of those unaffiliated with a religious community were willing to condone torture. A similar statistical trend was seen when comparing Americans who attended religious services regularly with those who seldom or never attended. 54% of weekly churchgoers believed torture was often or sometimes justified, while only 42% of those who rarely attended church felt the same way. How do we account for the fact that so many American citizens condone violence toward their fellow human beings? Pew researchers observed that, quote, "Party and ideology are much better predictors of views on torture than are religion and most other demographic factors," close quote. In other words, it appears that while religious affiliation is likely to influence your choice of political parties, the ideology of that political party tends to control your ethical and theological reflection. The real problem in this instance, in my opinion, is that religious groups often lack influence on believers. While very few faith leaders ever endorse torture as an appropriate response to terrorism, the fact remains that a majority of devout American Christians justified it in their own minds. Admittedly, the ethics of torture is an extreme test case. But it still shows how selective we tend to be in our promotion of justice. If you hope to cultivate the virtue of justice in your personal life, you need to understand how to overcome your blind spots. In the case of torture, the blindness often starts with an admirable desire to protect ourselves and loved ones from the threat of terrorism. Then, in the name of love and justice, and national security, and patriotism, we offer our blessing to those who would inflict severe physical and emotional pain on suspected terrorists. We're willing to commit inhumane acts of violence if there's a reasonable chance that it might produce useful intelligence to thwart a terrorist attack. The problem is that as crusaders for justice, we end up committing our own acts of injustice. Justice at any cost becomes injustice. The ethics of torture helps us understand why Aristotle and other ethicists would choose justice rather than love or benevolence as the cardinal virtue that regulates your conduct toward other people. The power of love is indispensable in transforming communities and healing hearts, but it still can't replace a commitment to universal principles of justice. Social scientific studies on bullying shed light on why both love and justice go hand in hand. This research concludes that successful intervention programs need to have a twofold focus. First, they need to help people cultivate a clearer sense of right and wrong. Social scientists call this moral competence. We might also call it a sense of justice. Second, Bullying intervention programs need to help children and adults develop emotional traits such as love or moral compassion. Studies show that these emotional traits are usually associated with responsible moral judgment. In a 2010 article, two social psychologists from Italy joined with a Harvard psychologist to study children who could be classified as one of the following: bullies, victims of bullying, or defenders of victims. Each of these children were categorized based on peer nominations related to questions such as, in your classroom, who are the classmates who more often hit or push other classmates? In your classroom, who are the classmates who more often get attacked hard, hit, or pushed by some other classmates? And, in your classroom, who are the classmates who more often defend others who are hit or attacked hard? This study found that young bullies often exhibited the characteristics of adult psychopaths. While they had a highly developed knowledge of right and wrong, and the ability to discern the desires and beliefs of their peers, they lacked the moral sensibilities that affirmed the significance of these insights. In other words, they seemed to understand in their own minds the principles of justice, but the bullies did not feel guilty about transgressing these principles, showing, quote, deficiencies with respect to moral sentiments and caring and higher levels of moral disengagement, close quote. Victims of bullying, on the other hand, actually scored lower than bullies on measures of moral competence. Their personal sense of justice was underdeveloped. These results were consistent with other studies that indicate bullying victims have, quote, deficits in social skills, social problem solving, coping strategies, assertiveness, and emotional regulation, close quote. One of the most interesting aspects of this study, and perhaps the most relevant to our discussion, is what researchers discovered about their core comparison group. This group was made up of the defenders of bullying victims, who were, quote, pro-social individuals who actively intervene to stop the bullying, help and console bullied classmates, or ask for adults' intervention, close quote. These kids were found to rank highly on measures of both moral competence and moral compassion. They had, quote, relatively sophisticated social cognitive skills that extend to the moral domain, supported by a well-developed understanding of the mental states and feelings of others, close quote. So they understood the clear distinction between justice and injustice, and they had the emotional sensitivity to do something about it. In digesting this research, remember that our main goal is to understand how to cultivate justice as a personal virtue. The defenders of bullying victims provide an ideal case study in this context. The most salient point here is that you need a highly developed sense of right and wrong, as well as a refined emotional awareness of the needs of vulnerable people. Efforts to cultivate a refined sense of justice would need to focus on both moral competence and moral compassion. We might consider a deficit in either one of these two categories as a moral blind spot. Now let's return for a moment to the ethics of torture. As we've seen, people who end up condoning torture seem to be motivated by clan-based loyalties. While their ethical systems are grounded in human sympathy, they probably don't embrace the sort of sympathy that can be universalized. It's compassion or sympathy that's grounded in the love of family, faith, community, and country. The arguments for accepting torture as a moral option, even in rare cases, will almost always be grounded in clan-based loyalties. Some recent thoughts from cultural theorist Terry Eagleton's study of ethics are relevant in this context. Quote, morality is too vital a question to be left to the capricious big-heartedness of those who can afford to be affable. The vulnerable need a material bond or code of obligations to cover their backs, a precise piece of wording they can brandish when their superiors turn sour. A rule-bound ethics may sound less agreeable than a genial impulse, but its point is that you should behave humanely to others, whatever you happen to be feeling. Close quote. If our moral sensibility is grounded in the sort of sympathy and compassion that's confined to family, friends, and fellow citizens, can it ever be universalized to apply to an alleged terrorist captured in Afghanistan or Iraq? As Eagleton reminds us, the life of virtue requires more than spontaneous human sympathy and compassion. Other qualities are needed as well, including a firm commitment to the universal sort of justice we've been talking about. Eagleton suggests that sometimes a duty-based ethic is more fruitful than one based on the virtue of love. He argues that, quote, love for the Judeo-Christian tradition has precious little to do with fellow feeling. If you rely on your affections, you are likely to end up acting compassionately only in the case of those you happen to care for anyway, or only when you feel like it, close quote. Perhaps the virtue of justice could be developed more fully if we simply embrace the golden rule as the main guide in how we treat others. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. Interestingly, a recent poll on torture primed American respondents with a question that led them to reflect on the relevance of the golden rule. Before being primed with this question, only 38% of respondents said torture was never or rarely justified. After being asked if they would agree that, quote, the U.S. government should not use methods against our enemies that we would not want used on American soldiers, a much higher percentage, 52%, of respondents said torture was never or rarely justified. In other words, researchers found that many respondents were less likely to accept the morality of torture after reflecting on the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule reminds us that we're all connected. Treating other people unjustly, even your enemies, tends to come back eventually to harm you. Here again, one of the reasons to promote a justice-based ethic is to rise above the moral blindness that can be caused by emotional attachment. After being told that interrogational torture provides information that could save American lives, a much higher percentage of respondents condone torture. By appealing to clan-based loyalties, some polls prime respondents with a noble impulse, such as mercy or compassion toward their fellow citizens. But in this case, the noble impulse becomes a kind of cognitive blind spot. Clearly, emotions can have both positive and negative effects on the work of justice. Love or compassion, as a positive emotion, can be turned to a negative effect when it's combined with fear, when it means harming someone to protect loved ones. Anger, on the other hand, is typically a negative emotion. But it can be turned to positive effect if it energizes a rectifying and fair response to injustice. In summary, here's what we've learned from history and social science about how we can develop justice as a cardinal virtue. First, because the work of justice is so difficult, we learn from the life of Martin Luther King that it often requires something akin to a religious call. Second, Dr. King's successful work as a civil rights leader shows that nonviolent resistance is a historically proven method to achieve justice. Third, we all have blind spots regarding the application of justice. Without continuous open dialogue with our fellow citizens, we will often fail to transform unjust attitudes and address our own moral blind spots. Fourth, an over-reliance on an ethic of love can lead to injustice grounded in clan-based loyalties. Justice must be built on universal principles that apply to all human beings, especially the most vulnerable among us. Fifth, the work of justice requires both moral compassion and moral competence. These two qualities can be captured harmoniously by a commitment to the Golden Rule, treating others how you would like to be treated. Sixth, while the struggle for justice is universal, most of us can find ample work within our families and local communities. Such work nurtures justice as both a personal virtue and as a state of society. In our last podcast segment, we'll discuss some final practical tips on how to cultivate justice in our family, community, and nation. Welcome back to The Character Cure. Justice, Part 3. Let's conclude with some practical tips on cultivating a greater sense of justice in our character and within our families and communities. Here's the first and most important tip. Treat those closest to you justly, with kindness, fairness, and mercy. We've emphasized that justice follows a set of universal principles and that love for family and friends can make you blind to the injustices experienced by people outside your small circle of loved ones. But the answer to overcoming blind spots is obviously not to diminish your love for those closest to you. On the contrary, justice calls for emotional awareness and moral compassion that begins with family and then overflows to embrace the most vulnerable, whoever and wherever they are. You start with those closest to you, being careful not to get caught on the side of injustice at home or among friends. Remember that justice is often more about forgiveness and mercy than holding people accountable to rigid expectations and unbending rules. The bottom line is to treat everyone you meet, including strangers, with dignity, humanity, and respect. Whether or not you feel called to be part of a social or political movement, you are called to promote justice in your personal life. The next tip is more directly related to addressing your blind spots. Engage in interpersonal dialogue. No matter how open-minded and magnanimous you think you are, we all have biases, prejudices, and areas of ignorance. The key to overcoming moral blindness is dialogue. Talk with people outside your usual circles of trusted friends, colleagues, and family members. When you find yourself dismissing fellow citizens as misguided, warped, or villainous, chances are that you haven't made much effort to understand them. Probe deeper to discover the true source of their concerns, their reasons for taking certain positions on social and political issues. I remember sitting in a graduate school class several years ago when someone asked an African-American student if he had ever been pulled over by the police for a traffic violation. I'll never forget his response. With an expression of utter disbelief, he timidly asked, "Are you kidding me?" He then described the dozen or so times he had been pulled over for minor violations. I was well enough acquainted with this young man to know he was completely truthful. As a white college student, during that same span of years, I had never been pulled over by the police. Needless to say, this experience opened my eyes a bit more to the reality of racial profiling and other possible injustices within the law enforcement community. Your clan-based loyalties will almost always limit how deeply you care about problems outside your social circles, unless you make a habit of talking with people. The idea of interpersonal dialogue leads me to the next practical tip. Use practical wisdom in determining your personal role in addressing social and political injustice. This requires an understanding of both sides of issues. In most cases, you can't see both sides unless you actually talk with people you disagree with. When it comes to something like racial profiling or police brutality, you need enough empathy to hear the voices of victims. But you also need to hear from the law enforcement officers themselves. In responding to injustice, you can't move forward blindly without balance. Remember, justice at any cost can become vengeance, and vengeance is not justice. Fighting injustice with more injustice poisons your character and weakens your social bonds. Justice at any cost also doesn't require a lot of practical wisdom. It does require courage and a passionate commitment to the rectifying side of justice. You and I typically need a dose of anger to rouse us from apathy regarding acts of injustice. But practical wisdom calls for clear-sighted and controlled action. This doesn't mean that you embrace the doctrine of gradualism, which was a giant obstacle for Martin Luther King in his struggle for civil rights. Wait until the time is right, he was told. Don't move too quickly, or you will lose the goodwill of your white empathizers. Well, sometimes practical wisdom does call for revolutionary action. Sometimes this is the difficult and strenuous right answer. However, even in a revolution, timing and the choice of means are critical. In the battle for justice, practical wisdom is indispensable. One final tip. Social justice is built on the foundation of respect for human dignity. As with Martin Luther King's call for nonviolent resistance, your goal cannot be to destroy your enemies or to humiliate those who've done you harm. When interacting with your fellow citizens, most of the time you can work out conflicts without bitter, caustic name-calling. There are very few circumstances that warrant demonizing or dehumanizing those who offend your sense of justice. Yes, injustice should be called by its proper name. Racism is racism, bigotry is bigotry, prejudice is prejudice, no matter how small or insignificant it may seem to its perpetrator. But the claim that we're all in this life together means that we should make an effort to reconcile and heal our differences rather than deepen our conflicts. In some cases, cultivating a keen sense of justice can make you overly sensitive to every slight, even the smallest breach of justice. These are moments when forgiveness is far more powerful than demonizing. It rarely hurts to give friends and fellow citizens the benefit of the doubt. Offenses are often the unintentional result of moral blind spots. So there we have four practical tips. First, cultivate justice, kindness, and fairness in your personal relationships. Second, talk with people in your community who don't necessarily share your values and perspectives on justice. Third, use practical wisdom to understand and embrace your personal call to promote justice within your community. Then find the courage to act. Fourth, refrain from dehumanizing or demonizing those who offend you. Whenever possible, choose reconciliation and forgiveness over name-calling and retribution. I'll end with a personal challenge. We've talked a lot about moral blind spots and the way we think about justice. These blind spots typically lead to injustice in the way we treat particular people. So my challenge is to identify a person in your life whom you dislike, someone you believe doesn't deserve your attention, someone unworthy of your kindness. Now, take advantage of an opportunity to talk with this person. Humble yourself and discover what they care most deeply about. Ask them to share with you their greatest anxiety as well as their greatest source of joy. No matter how they respond to your questions, treat their answers with respect. Rather than passing judgment, open your mind with a forgiving attitude and establish a genuine human connection with this person. That's about all we have time to say about justice as a personal virtue. To conclude, achieving justice is often extremely difficult and labor-intensive. Within your circles of influence, you have opportunities to relieve suffering, to rectify past injustices in some small way. Establishing a just society requires working with people who don't always share your values, people who may see the world much differently than you do. But we're all in this life together, whether we like it or not. Justice, as the highest of all virtues, relies upon our shared humanity and our commitment to the most vulnerable among us. Thanks for joining me. For more resources on character education, check out my website at charactercure.com.